So I would like to go ahead and go over the mechanism for this Robinson annulation. Annulation from annulus, which means ring. So this is the Robinson ring-forming reaction. It's a combination of two different alpha reactions, one of which we have not studied yet, and it's going to be the most confusing part of the lecture today because it involves what's called conjugate addition. If you think back to dienes from last quarter, we talked about 1,2 versus 1,4 addition, where we're going to see a different 1,4 addition today. It's going to be followed up by an aldol condensation, something that we've already seen before. So the combination of this new Michael addition, which under circumstances will be followed by this aldol condensation, that's a Robinson annulation. Before we actually get to that, though, I want to revisit conjugation a bit, and more importantly, I want to talk about charge distribution. Because it turns out for unsaturated ketones and aldehydes, which we have an unsaturated ketone as one of our reagents today, those compounds can have two different modes in the way they react. There is 1,2 addition and 1,4 addition. And which one happens is going to depend on what kind of reagent you have, what kind of charge distribution you have on that reagent. So I want to just talk about that topic independent of the mechanism, because there's enough going on in the mechanism that it's probably going to be confusing enough as it is. Now, I want to point out, just for the recording's sake, that my old laptop gave up practically during lab yesterday, so they did not have their lab recording recorded. So this is going to serve for the recording for all three sections, which means we have to talk very nice about sections 1 and 2 today. Because we love sections 1 and 2, right? Right, okay. Sure, there we go. So let's visit this topic of charge distribution, which we have had this in a tangential sense back in 12A. You might remember this term polarizability that came up. And if you don't remember it, it came up in context of nucleophiles. For example, if you have OH minus and SH minus, the question is typically asked, which one's the better nucleophile? And even though you're used to oxygen being basic, and even though there's this close relationship between nucleophilicity and basicity, they're not the same thing. And it turns out that sulfur, even though it's not as basic, is the better nucleophile, because its charge is, well, the term we use was squishy. It had this not as densely packed charge, which meant that it was able to begin the process of bond formation more easily than oxygen did. And so that's what made it the better nucleophile. There's some older terminology that's often used to describe ions that have a broader distributed charge versus ions that charge, which might be the same in magnitude, but it's more compact. And I don't know if they use this terminology at all still in general chemistry textbooks, but they refer to hard and soft ions. And hard ions meaning ones that do have that compact charge, and soft ions where the charge is squishier. So using that terminology, hydroxide would be, by comparison, a hard ion, and the SH minus would be a soft ion. Now, why do these hard-soft designations matter? Well, it's all about charge interaction. So let me draw a couple of pictures up, and let's talk about charges interacting. So let's say that here we have what are referred to as hard charges or hard ions, which means charge density is high, which means the ion is compact. And let's not worry about whether these are real physical objects or not, the way I've drawn them. This is just for argument's sake. But here are broader charges, and let's presume that these are of equal magnitude to the first set of charges that I drew up. So 1 plus, 1 plus, 1 minus, 1 minus. But it's the shape of that plus or minus that's different between these two. And so again, these other two would be referred to as soft ions. And again, the charge density is lower. And because I like the word so much, the previous time we used it, put the highly technically word squishy in there to describe these. Now let's talk about different interactions between ions. If we had the two compact charges interacting with each other, there's only a very small volume right near the charge where its charge density has the maximum effect. I don't know that everybody's had physics, but hopefully you know that how strong an interaction between charges you have depends on how close those charges are to each other. So if the ion itself is small, then ideally you'd want some other small ion to interact with it so you have the max amount of interaction between those two charges. Similarly, for the distributed charges, if those two objects line up in the correct way, then even though at any one point there's not as much interaction between the charges, given the whole interaction that's going on, adding up the whole surface there, then there's be a good interaction between those two objects. Now, what if we mismatched the objects then? Well, again, it's going to be wherever the objects are closest to each other that interaction between charge is at a maximum. So if you have a broad charge interacting with a compact charge, it's only where those two objects are closest that you have the best charge interaction. And as that broad charge gets further and further away, yes, there's an interaction, but, okay, now, boy, it's been a while. Force is proportional to 1 over radius, and energy is proportional to 1 over r squared. Where are my physics people? Coulomb's law, the force is 1 over r, and the energy is 1 over r squared, I believe. What's that? Oh, that's the other way around. That's right, because you multiply by distance. Okay, so force is 1 over r squared, energy is 1 over r then. Either way, the further away it is, the less of effect there is. So there's not going to be as much overall interaction, even though the two charges are the same magnitude, in this case, because it's a matter of geometry. So hard ions tend to interact with each other, soft ions tend to interact with each other, but hard-soft interactions are not necessarily as productive. So let me write some of what I just said down, and we'll see where this shows up in this Robinson annulation. So the first set, in this case, the charges interact well. Because they have the maximum possible, I'll say physical, or what I really mean is geometrical interaction with each other. But over here, in this other case, because you have a small charge interacting with a distributed charge, the amount of interaction is reduced because it's only effective locally. And because, again, you have part of the charge that's further away, not as good an interaction. So again, the summary, the point of this discussion is that charges of similar charge density prefer to interact with each other. Now, switching gears, let's get into the mechanism. Are there any questions before I do start the mechanism? So we're going to be talking about alpha chemistry today in lecture. We're going to get to not more condensations today, but further investigating alpha chemistry. When we do get to the condensations in lecture, we're primarily going to be doing just anionic mechanisms that are caused by a base, because in fact certain of the reactions can't even happen in acid. This Michael and Aldol and together the Robinson annulation, they can be done either under acidic or basic conditions. But this mechanism in particular, going all the way through a Robinson under acidic conditions, is not the one normally presented in texts even, and it's not what we're going to see again in lecture, because again, mostly we're going to be using bases. So, the mechanism I'm about to show you is only going to be tested upon here in lab. The idea of what a Michaelin addition is, of what a Robinson annulation is, that will be a lecture topic, because we're going to get to those reactions. But we will do them in base form in lecture. So again, this only just this mechanism, not the reactions, that will be a lab quiz topic and will not show up in lecture. Is that clear enough? Okay, so let's start. We have two starting materials. We have that unsaturated stinky ketone. Plus 2-methylpropanol. Which of these compounds would you guess is more reactive? Aldehyde. Normally aldehydes are more reactive than ketones, and I believe that is still the case here, but there's something I hadn't considered before, and I need to go investigate this my own self. What do you think the pKa of the ketone is? Because what's the standard pKa of a ketone? 19 roughly. But things that somehow stabilize the ketone make them less acidic, right? So what's the double bond going to do? It's going to do conjugation, which makes me think that this is even less base or less acidic than it normally would be. Because again, if this is providing electron density into the carbonyl, then if you form a negative charge here, you have competition between the double bond and that negative charge as far as being in resonance with that carbonyl. And thinking through on the spot, I think we can come up with a resonance structure that would delocalize that negative ion, but I think it would be unfavorable if it involved the double bond also. So I want to go and investigate on my own what that pKa should be. I'm just pointing that out, though, but I'm going to come back and say it is the aldehyde in this case that does react first. And it does form an enol. And this is going to go through the acid-style tautomerization, which, remember, back in Chem 12A, we saw the formation of enols when we did reactions of alkynes. And those enols, we said, instantly tautomerized because the enol is unfavorable. So if we're going to be making an enol, especially since it's by the acid mechanism, and since what we're making is thermodynamically not favorable, this whole reaction has to be reversible, every portion of it. So the standard way to show that mechanism, for the carbonyl to be protonated. I'm not going to do it in this case, but let me point out, I've already said, I think, a few times that resonance doesn't count as a reaction step because resonance is not a reaction. So if you wanted to combine the carbonyl opening into the step, that's acceptable. Since I haven't been doing it in this particular situation, I'm not going to do it today. But it would be allowable. To amplify that, because the concern came up, well, it might be allowable, but what are you going to do when it comes time to grade the exams? Well, I said it's allowable, so if you did it, it would be perfectly fine. As long as you're just combining resonance with something else. So I'll show the resonance separately. So we've made the carbocation. Now notice I've got two hydrogens drawn in, ignoring the hydrogen on the oxygen. Be careful which one you eliminate at this point. I drew the hydrogen on the bottom right only because I'm acknowledging that we came from an aldehyde. But that's not an alpha proton. That is the proton on the carbonyl itself. So that proton will not be the one eliminated. It's the one next door that is the true alpha proton that you must eliminate at this point. Now notice that to make this happen, we had to protonate the carbonyl first. In all the other steps you're going to see, whatever reaction occurs happens by first protonating the carbonyl. Now, this enol, there's no charge on here, but it's in terms of electron density, would you say it's compact or distributed in this molecule? You think it's compact? Why would you say that? What makes you think that?
It has the oxygen.
Yeah. Ah, okay, I see what you're saying. But let me give a counter argument, because what you're saying is the oxygen is delta plus, and you have this.
No, the oxygen with the carbon.
makes the carbon delta plus. But doesn't the oxygen also have a lone pair on it? And even though it would end up making a charge-separated structure, isn't there resonance possible here? In fact, that's the whole idea behind the tautomerization, that there's somehow this tendency for the charge to get delocalized. If we were in basic conditions, this whole discussion would be easier, because if you have an enolate, that's by definition a distributed ion. So I'm going to write in a different color to the side the fact that we have a possible resonance structure here, because this is to give us the setup that this is a delocalized or a squishy compound. Now, what other material do we have in here? We have the ketone, which for the same reasons we could call squishy, because this is not just resonance now, this is full conjugation. So, if you had just a carbonyl, that was the only functional group on the molecule, of course the carbonyl is what would be attacked by the enol. Even in this kind of conjugated system, if we had a Grignard reagent, it'll still attack the carbonyl because of that difference in polarity. But there are other alkylating agents that we have not discussed. Does anybody, and this is totally random and totally understandable if you haven't, but did anybody remember reading about dialkyl cuprates at any point in the past couple of quarters? Because we skipped over those sections as far as class. But they're a form of alkylating agent. They do the same types of things like Grignard reagents, but they are softer bases. And again, these softer, squishier bases would rather react in a distributed way. And so they add not to the carbonyl, but to the end of the double bond, pushing it into the carbonyl. Which, if something then adds to the oxygen that's on the other side, that would be 1, 2, 3, 4, the relative positions. So it's a 1-4 addition. We're going to cover that in lecture properly, so because we need to revisit this idea of conjugation, especially once we hit the Michael reaction in lecture. Point of telling you that about Grignard reagents or alkylating reagents is that the enol, which is squishy, is going to react with this ketone, which is squishy, in this delocalized fashion. As I said just a moment before that, though, because this is an acidic mechanism, we're first going to protonate that ketone to activate it. That means we're adding at the one position, you could say. Now, we have the enol. The enol tries to reform the carbonyl. That's what always happens in these alpha reactions. Whichever compound made the enol or the enolate reforms into the carbonyl. This is going to push the carbon-carbon double bond open, which, again, because we have this squishy interaction, It's going to attack the end of the molecule, not the carbonyl. That will push the double bond into the carbonyl, which, since it's protonated, simply opens up. So again, if we call the oxygen the one position, and we call this carbon here the four position, this is 1,4 overall addition, conjugate addition. What do we get? Well, I just said a moment ago, we're going to get a carbonyl. We form a new carbon-carbon bond. So like an aldol reaction, a new bond is formed at the alpha position relative to the carbonyl that is retained. So that would be equivalent to the 4 position of the ketone, the way I'd labeled it here. We then have one more carbon, which that's where a double bond's going to be now, because we made an enol. Oh my gosh, and I did it for the third time now. We got to make one small change in just a moment, but let me finish with this. Here's our enol, and then we have one more methyl group here. If you look at the top, though, I made a mistake, because yes, we reformed the carbonyl, but it's going to be protonated at first, right after this reaction. So look at this. Go back, put a hydrogen there. Do you have that whiteout? Let's get rid of that.
Lone electron there.
There we go. Got it. Got it. Thank you. So then we'll have a deprotonation. And we'll get to our first intermediate, which won't be isolatable. Why? Because it's an enol. Now, before I continue with the rest of this, though, let me summarize what we talked about so far. So we had this discussion about charge density and how compact charges prefer to react with other compact charges, non-compact ones don't. The reason I brought that up is because the first thing that happens after forming the enol is this Michael addition, which, did I write that name down here yet? No. Michael addition is conjugate addition because you have two systems that are distributed in their electron density, and they would prefer to interact in a way that maximizes that interaction between electron density, which is why they add 1,4 style in this case. From here, we're going to do an aldol condensation. I already told you this is called an annulation or a ring-forming reaction, so we know that somehow this thing's going to fold up together. What's one possible way we could guess that that might happen? Well, we have an enol. And remember that enols or enolates are the things that do aldol condensations. We have a carbonyl right next door. But what if an aldol reaction was going to happen with the molecule just the way it is? How many carbons or how many atoms would be in the ring? Imagine an aldol condensation is happening. Try to figure out how many carbons or atoms would be in the ring. 5? Well, let's
let's double check how we count, because remember that here where the enol is, it is the alpha position that creates the bond. So if you were looking at the carbon where the alcohol is, that is not in the ring, it would be exterior to the ring. So the alpha position would be 1, the carbon yield up above would be 2, we have 2 more atoms in between them, so we'd actually have a 4-membered ring. Are 4-membered rings likely to form? But it will. But it won't be isolatable, because the whole reaction is reversible. And here's one of the main points that confused both other sections. There are a zillion side reactions I could write mechanisms for here. Everywhere where there's a neutral oxygen, you could show it being deprotonated. Everywhere you have a protonated oxygen, you could show it being deprotonated, and back and forth and back and forth. Where you have an enol, you could show tautomerization, and you could show it being tautomerized back again. We could show this condensation to make a 4-membered ring and show it opening up again. There's a whole variety of things we could show, but we want to write the most compact mechanism we can. And I'm saying all this to set up what I'm about to show you next, because a 4-membered ring is not favorable. But don't we have another alpha proton on the other side of what would have been the carbonyl there? In other words, if we could tautomerize and get the double bond to point out instead of in, we then would be able to take that carbon, wrap it around, and make a 6-membered ring. That is favorable, and that's what happens. But when I show that the shift of that double bond, is it really necessary for me to show all the way to making the ketone, doing the full tautomerization, if as soon as you make it, it's just going to unreact again? No. So let me show you what I'm getting at here. Yeah. So first, let me make a comment about the 4-membered ring. As an exercise, you might want to go back and confirm that I drew the product correctly. We can do a really quick and dirty double check by just counting carbons. 1, 2, 3, 4 in one of the starting materials, 1, 2, 3, 4 in the other. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8 in the product. Carbonyl reforms with a methyl group sticking off of it. Here is that carbonyl. And remember that a full aldol condensation can result in an alpha-beta unsaturation, which is why I've got the double bond. So this will happen. But it's not favorable, and so you can add water to the double bond, and the whole thing unfolds in reverse. Because let me write, I hadn't said it yet in this section today, but I guess this is the perfect place to introduce it. If equilibrium can happen, it will happen. Just like things roll downhill, even at the mystery spot. So if this can happen, it's going to form. But that doesn't mean it sticks around. Back up to the very start of the mechanism. Enols don't like to form. But if it can, it will. So a little bit of enol forms, and it starts this whole process off. So if equilibrium can happen, it will happen. But this product is not favorable. So it will reverse. So what will happen? As I indicated, we could have tautomerization of this intermediate.
which if I wrote the full tautomerization mechanism, I first would show the double bond being protonated. Which is going to generate a positive charge. I could then reform the carbonyl. And have it deprotonate. But if an enol can form, it will form. And realize that where I just got to, that carbonyl is going to have to get protonated to make an enol, which means I back up to this previous step. The carbonyl is going to open to make the carbocation, which means I back up to this previous step. So if I'm going to end up here again anyways, why write 1, 2, 3, 4 extra steps just to go forward and back to the same place? Why not just pick the mechanism up right here and continue? That's the way I recommend that you're doing it. So I instead will show the forward process of the other alpha proton being removed. That gets us our new enol. Which, before we do the reactions, let's number our carbons. And in this case, it's going to be both just a set of numbers, but it will happen to match nomenclature numbers. So remember that the aldol condensation, which is what's about to happen next, a new bond is formed from the alpha position of one carbonyl to the carbonyl itself of the attacked carbonyl. So the attacked carbonyl is going to be position 1, the way I've drawn it out. The alpha proton is going to be position 6. That's going to give us our 6-membered ring. Since this is still an acidic mechanism, we need to protonate first. Then, the carbonyl tries to reform. The double bond opens up as a response, attacks the other carbonyl, which opens up as a response. So one carbonyl disappears, turns into an alcohol. The other carbonyl is still there, but it's protonated because it started out with a hydrogen on it. Let's number our carbons to make sure I did this correctly. where the carbonyl was, that's still position one. The two methyl groups still in position two. Three, four, five is where the alcohol portion of the enol was and where the carbonyl is now reformed. And six is what's connected to the first carbonyl. So we deprotonate. So we have our beta hydroxy ketone, which remember that aside from a new carbon-carbon bond, one of the ways to recognize an aldol condensation is the formation of an OH group at the beta position. Then, since we're in acidic conditions, since you heated it for a prolonged period of time, the alcohol can get protonated. Water leaves as a leaving group. And then an alpha proton can be eliminated. To make our alpha beta unsaturated ketone. And so overall, we had a Michael addition plus an aldol condensation. And the two of them together, when they make a ring, are called the Robinson annulation. Which, for emphasis, let me repeat, this is one of my favorite mechanisms from the quarter. So you can judge the likelihood of this entire mechanism showing up on the lab quiz. Yes? Oh, I put OH, sorry, yes, water. Questions?